There's this misconception that those of us who broadcast the news understand the world better than everyone else, especially what things mean or what's going to happen next. Scott Pelley has described journalism as the world's greatest continuing education program. The funny thing is, the more he's learned, the more questions he seems to have, including perhaps the big one on everyone's mind right now: where are we going? And will we get there intact? 4 decades in journalism, including 3 at CBS News, have given him insight on the people leading us into that future and the values that might give us a future we can be proud of. Today, he is a correspondent for 60 Minutes. His new memoir is called Truth Worth Telling: A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. And he joins us from KUVO Public Radio in Denver. Scott, welcome to 1A.
Thank you, Joshua. Great to be with you.
Why a memoir right now?
Well, I wanted to write a memoir, but I didn't want to write a memoir about me. I didn't think anybody would care about that. But it did occur to me that over the 30 years that I've been at CBS, the 20 years at 60 Minutes, that I had met the most fascinating people in the world, and I wanted to write about them, people who had discovered really the meaning of their lives in some of the great historic events of our times.
Speaking of some of those fascinating people, you begin the book with your account of the September 11th terror attacks. You were on the ground reporting right near the two towers of the World Trade Center. Here is a bit of your live coverage with Dan Rather on that morning.
Dan, we were literally at the base of building number 7 about an hour or so ago with a number of New York City firefighters and police officers. At that time, the building was fully involved in flame. There were large panes of glass crashing down into the street. And at that moment, the firefighters told us that there was a good chance that building number 7 was going to collapse. That appears to be what has happened now.
Part of your live reporting on the day of the September 11th terror attacks. Now, what stood out to me, Scott, from the way you wrote about this at the top of the book, was not so much that you were writing about what you experienced, although clearly it was horrifying for you as it was for everyone else. You tell a lot of the stories behind, I mean, how the World Trade Center was constructed and what the symbol on the Fire Department of New York's uniform means. I mean, 343 FDNY, you know, firefighters lost their lives on that day, but you go into a lot of detail kind of telling the whole factual backstory around 9/11. Why start that way?
Well, this chapter is entitled Gallantry, and I just wanted it to pay some kind of adequate tribute to the members of the FDNY who sacrificed themselves on that day. The funny thing, Joshua, about being an eyewitness to events, you don't know very much. All you know is what you saw. What has happened in the intervening years is that there have been volumes and volumes of engineering studies about why and how the buildings fell down, volumes and volumes of 911 calls and FDNY radio transmissions that were either lost or were sealed in court cases or sealed by the city of New York that have now become available. So I was able to take this enormous amount of information, go through all of it, and inform what it was that I had seen with my own eyes. One of the things that fascinated me, Joshua, was that no steel tower in the history of the world had ever collapsed because of fire. And that's why those firefighters were flowing into those buildings. That's why the chief of the department at the incident command post had confidence, because no one in history had ever seen the kind of collapse that we all witnessed.
There's a quote near the top of the book that you included in the CBS Evening News in November 2015 after the ISIS attack on Paris. You said, in these times, don't ask the meaning of life. Life is asking, what's the meaning of you? What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I was in Paris after 120 people had been killed by ISIS, and I saw all these people bringing candles to this makeshift memorial on a cobblestone street. There were men and women and children. They all had the same expression on their face, a sense of bewilderment, sort of a, what is all of this about? What is life about? And I realized in that moment that I had seen these people before. I saw them at the World Trade Center on 9/11. I saw them in Oklahoma City when the Murrah Federal Building was bombed. And I had been reading Viktor Frankl's testimony from the Holocaust, which was published in the 1940s under the title of Man's Search for Meaning. And it occurred to me that having read Frankl, having all of this life experience, seeing people continually bewildered by what was happening in the world, that the real question was, what do I stand for in this moment? Who am I? Not what is the meaning of life, but what is the meaning of me? And so that's how this book is organized. It's about the firefighters at the FDNY. It's about a nurse that I met at a combat hospital in Iraq. It's about people who discovered the meaning of their lives.
I want to talk more about the meaning that you found over your journalistic career as we continue our conversation with 60 Minutes correspondent Scott Pelley. We'll get to some more of your questions. I'd also like to ask you about something that you mentioned just over this weekend about your transition out of the anchor chair on the CBS Evening News and how it relates to the Me Too movement and some of the challenges that your company has been dealing with over the last few months. We'll get into that and we'll get to more of your questions in just a minute. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Scott Pelley of CBS News. He is a correspondent on 60 Minutes. His new book is called Truths Worth Telling. I wonder, with regards to that quote we read from the book about what's the meaning of you, one of our listeners asks how you would answer that. What's the meaning of his life, they ask?
You know, I think it might be different at different stages in life. I've always felt strongly as a journalist, since I was a kid, I started in this business at the age of 15, but I always felt strongly about giving voice to the voiceless, pursuing the truth, exposing lies, all of that. Today, I think the meaning of my life is a little bit different. I'd like to be a stepping stone today for young journalists going forward, because this is such an important and even dangerous time in our country, in my view. You know, what is the fastest way to destroy a democracy? Is it terrorism? Is it war? Is it another Great Depression? I don't think so. I think the fastest way to destroy a democracy is to poison the information. I think the Russians, I think the North Koreans, I think other actors around the world understand this very well. And this is precisely where journalism comes in. This is precisely where people who've been trained in journalism, who've been trained to ask, is this story right? Is it fair? Is it honest? That's where they come in. The American people, Joshua, can't take the power that the founders gave us unless they have reliable, independent information. And I think journalism going forward in our internet age has never been more important.
Do you think that the American people still want that, though, Scott? I mean, there's going to be a future for CBS News and a lot of other mainstream outlets. But, you know, you write about and you spoke in your commentary on CBS Sunday Morning just a few days ago about the nature of partisan media that kind of reaffirms what people already think. We had this doctored video of Nancy Pelosi that appeared to show her slurring her words, which basically was just someone who went into Adobe After Effects and slowed down the tape that Facebook would not take down and said it just kind of wanted to let people make up their own minds about this. I wonder if you see it as just more challenging to do this kind of journalism or less marketable, whether people even feel like they want it anymore.
You know, this is exactly what worries me about our beloved country. We have gone seamlessly from the information age to the disinformation age. That is the poison that will destroy our democracy. Think about this. What's more effective if you want to attack America? What's more effective, a 9/11 terrorist attack that unites the entire country, or an insidious poisoning of our information that sets us at each other's throats? This is exactly what worries me. This is precisely where journalism comes in. This is why I am so eager to educate a new generation of journalists. There is no democracy without journalism.
You've also, in the book, you use a phrase that's pretty interesting. I do want to get some more listener questions, but instead of this phrase, "United we stand," that we hear so much, you use the phrase, "Divided we stand." What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, that's always been the secret of America, right? We are an amalgam of all the peoples in the world. There is only one way for a country as incredibly diverse as ours to succeed, and that is through democracy, where everyone has a voice. And the point that I wanted to make there was that everyone needs to be heard. I said in the Sunday morning commentary, you know, look at the American flag. There are no flags that show the stars of liberal states and show the stars of conservative states. There are 50 stars. Every school child knows that. So what does that mean? That means we're supposed to gather as a people and talk to each other, listen to each other, get all of our stars on that blue field that is called the Union. The American flag itself is the very icon of compromise.
Let me get to some of our listeners' questions now. Bill asked on our Facebook page, how has political journalism changed over the decades and why?
Well, Bill and everyone, political journalism has changed in that there are so many venues out there and too many of them are false. You know, we live in this time where never before in human history has more information been available to more people. I mean, it's an evolutionary change in humanity, and that's a great thing. But we also live in this time when never in human history has more bad information been available to more people. That's what concerns me about political journalism today. Now, the audience may be thinking to themselves, what am I supposed to do about all of this misinformation that's out there? My advice is to do the thing you could never do before now, and that is compare what you're seeing, compare what you have been outraged by or appalled by on the internet. You mentioned the Nancy Pelosi video. And then look, ask yourself, what is NPR saying about this? What is, take your pick, the Chicago Tribune, the Dallas Morning News, the New York Times? What are others saying about this? Triangulate your information. And the one thing you know about brand names, the brand name journalists you can trust, is that at the very least, those are people who've been trained in journalism. They're being supervised by people who've been in journalism for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. And the most important thing is they have enormous reputational risk if they get something wrong. They are not fooling around. They are asking themselves, is this right? Is it fair? Is it honest? And now, the reader, the viewer, has a responsibility that they have never had before, and that is to choose a diet of information that's going to be good for your brain and therefore good for our democracy.
It's got to be a little frustrating for you, though, Scott. I mean, you work at a venerated news organization that was considered the gold standard for broadcast journalism, God, since Edward R. Murrow and Eric Severide and, you know, Fred Friendly and Walter Cronkite and, you know, Mike Wallace and Harry Reasoner and on and on and on, where people used to just be able to say, okay, I'm going to CBS. What did Walter Cronkite say? That's what's really happening. And now we have this, at times, cacophony of voices. But at the same time, the era of Walter Cronkite was not the view from the whole country. It was the view from the white men who were at the top of the news organizations of the country. So you're kind of inside one of these organizations that's been smack in the middle of all this change.
But this is the beauty part right now, I think, Joshua. If you watch the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite in 1972, that's all you saw. You didn't see what they reported on NBC or ABC or anything else. That was your only opportunity. All the rest of it was gone. You'd have to wait 24 hours to see what other people were reporting in broadcasting. Now, today, you can see anything anytime you want to. You can ask yourself as a viewer, what did NBC say about this? What did NPR say about this? And the beauty part is you can do that in a matter of a minute or two or three. You can actually triangulate the information. Before, we had our major news organizations in the country, and they were generally reliable, and so people could trust them. Today, you can't trust what you see on the internet, and so this is a brand new, first time in human history, responsibility that we have as citizens. The founders were counting on us to be active, proactive citizens in order to wield the power that they gave us over the government. And so in order to do that properly now, you have to choose your information diet and you have to be smart about it.
Clem asks, do you think mainstream news media all too often try to normalize President Trump instead of holding him accountable?
I don't think so. I think mainstream media, which, by the way, has been given a pejorative connotation by some, I want to be in the mainstream. I want to be in the middle of the mainstream. I don't want to be on some tributary to the left or to the right. I want to be with the majority of the American people, people who listen to the other side to make sure they understand the issues. And so I don't think we've tried to normalize the White House under Donald Trump. When I was anchoring the evening news in that first year of the Trump administration, we were very frank about where the president was telling the truth and where he was not, which led the president to call CBS News the enemy of the American people. And I sat down with the president weeks after that, and I said, Mr. President, I'm concerned about this rhetoric that you're using, that it will create violence, that some poor, deranged individual will walk into some TV station or radio station and kill the receptionist because she's the enemy of the American people. And the president paused for a moment, and he looked at the ceiling, and then he looked back down at me, and he said, and this is a direct quote, he said, I don't worry about that. Well, when you begin to talk about enemy of the American people, think about what Madison wrote. Madison wrote that freedom of the press is the right that guarantees all the others. Madison was saying that if we could say what we want to say, write what we want to write, read what we want to read, then all of our rights in the Bill of Rights would be protected. That's how America has come so far in these 220 or so years, and I believe that that is our future.
You mentioned your tenure at the Evening News. I did want to ask you about something you mentioned on Sunday in conversation with CNN's Brian Stelter. You said that you ultimately lost your seat as the anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News because you complained about a hostile work environment toward women and toward men within the news division and would not stop complaining. I'm paraphrasing, but the way you described that about 4 or 5 years ago, you went to the head of the news division and complained about the hostile work environment, and basically he told you that if you kept agitating, it could affect your career. You worked your way up the chain and ultimately all the way to the chairman of the CBS Corporation, who, as it turned out, was Les Moonves, who was dropped from CBS over his own sexual assault allegations. I wonder how you reflect on that, particularly if you were aware of any of the accusations against Moonves at the time.
The answer to that question is no. I reflect on this with a little bit of surprise. I was surprised that people would talk about this because it was so long ago. It was years ago. What I'm the people who were involved in those years are all gone. In fact, they're long gone. And what we have now at CBS, I'm really excited about. We have a new chairman, Joe Iannello, a man I've known many years, a visionary CEO. We have a new news division president in Susan Zirinsky. I'm a little embarrassed to admit that she's the first woman president of CBS News, but she's been at CBS for 40 years. She has CBS News DNA, and I am so excited about her. And then finally, we have our new executive producer of 60 Minutes, Bill Owens, a man of tremendous principle. And I know that name doesn't mean anything to your listeners because all you know about 60 Minutes are the people who are on the air. But if you met Bill Owens, you would think, thank God, this guy is running 60 Minutes.
I should note, by the way, CBS News did issue a statement in response that reads, quote, Scott was expressing his own opinion. We disagree. CBS News has been working hard to advocate for an inclusive, safe, and dignified workplace for everyone at CBS News, and Scott has been a supporter of these efforts, unquote. That's the statement from CBS News. What about the timing of making this comment? You've made it now, you know, in the interview with Brian on Sunday. Why not speak up publicly sooner?
Well, why now? The answer is pretty simple. He asked. And, you know, this was something that I felt needed to be worked out through the company. And the company has done that. The board of directors came in, and we have new board members. We have, again, the new CEO. We have new leadership throughout the news division. This is just a very different CBS News. It's in my 30 years at CBS, I am more excited about our future today than I ever have been.
A few more quick comments before we got to let you go. One listener emailed, been a fan of Scott Pelley since his Dallas market days. Always a class act. Huh. And Matt asks, who was the most unforgettable person you met doing a story? I completely side with you if you say that you can't answer that, because people ask me that question all the time. I'm like, good question. There's no way I can answer that.
You know, I've done, I figure, about 450 pieces for 60 Minutes, and I love all my children. but there was one of the people I write about in the book is an Air Force nurse at a combat hospital. And I was in an operating room where a young Marine was bleeding to death through three lacerated arteries. And a nurse came into the OR and said, we're out of blood. We don't have any more fresh blood. And this nurse who was running the operating room, a woman named Paulette Shank, Lieutenant Colonel Paulette Shank, said, I'll get more. And I thought, well, what is she talking about? There is no more. We just found out there's no more blood for this young man. He's going to die. And she ran out of the tent, and I followed her to see what she was up to. By the time I got into the next tent, which was the blood bank, she had opened up her vein, and she was bleeding into bags that were being taken in to the young Marine, and that bought enough time for them to put an all-call out on the base to get 100 people in line to give blood. And I tell you what, that's one person I'll never forget.
Scott Pelley, a correspondent for 60 Minutes. His new book is called Truth Worth Telling, A Reporter's Search for Meaning in the Stories of Our Times. Scott, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for talking to us.
Joshua, so good to be with you on 1A. Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Gabrielle Healy. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for your stories and your questions, and thanks for listening. This is 1A.